Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Gary Bruce on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Firm, The Inside Story of the Stasi. You've probably heard of the Stasi. That is the East German secret police. If you've seen the movie The Lives of Others, you will have seen a depiction of the Stasi. I would not say, having read Gary's terrific book, that it is an entirely accurate depiction. In some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. What Gary shows is that the Stasi, for all that it was a formidable surveillance apparatus, really was kind of clay-footed. Their basic problem was that there was nothing for them to uncover because there was no East German resistance to the Communist Party or to the cause of communism. People didn't like particularly the fact that sausage was expensive or that they couldn't take vacations to East Germany, at least very easily. But to think that there was an organized opposition, well, that was a kind of paranoia. But the Stasi grew and grew, and they gave the impression that they watched everybody, which in a sense did the same work as watching everyone. That's really all you need to do. In any event, Gary has written a terrific book, and I really enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed talking to him. So without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Marshall.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I should tell our listeners that we have Gary Bruce on the show today, coming to us from Waterloo, Canada, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, The Firm, The Inside Story of the Stasi. I really like this book a lot. Gary interviewed a lot of people who are in the Stasi and informants for the Stasi and that kind of thing. And that really, I think, enriched the presentation. You know, unfortunately, when people die, they take most of the information they have in their heads with them. And we should thank Gary for going and getting some of this information from these people, because it paints a really interesting and I think a kind of counterintuitive, revelatory picture of the Stasi. Because, well, we'll talk about this during the interview, because I didn't really understand what the Stasi was about. Of course, then pretty much everything I knew came from Jean Le Carré novels, so that's not such a good source. But, Gary, why don't you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'll go fairly far back. My father was involved in shipping, and so we lived in a lot of ports when I was growing up. And my parents, for example, lived in Quebec City and Montreal before I was born. And then they moved to Duluth, Minnesota, where I was born. So I'm actually an American citizen, which is wonderful when it comes time for me to travel into the United States. But up here in Canada, I don't always boast about it. And then after a few years in Minnesota, we moved to Chicago and to a fairly affluent suburb of Chicago. We were there only a short time, and then I'm sure my parents, I was just a little kid, but I'm sure my parents experienced some cultural version of the bends, because they moved from Chicago, Illinois, to a very small town in Francophone Quebec called Port Cartier. And it was also it was on the St. Lawrence River, and as the name suggests, also a port where my dad continued his shipping work. So that's where I grew up. I grew up in the very far north of Quebec, getting close to the Labrador border. It was an interesting port. It was primarily served the iron ore mines in northern Quebec, but half the port was for the iron ore mines. The other half was a grain port, so there was an elevator there that took the grain from the prairies and transferred to overseas ships. And during the U.S. grain embargo against the Soviets, Port Cartier became a huge exporter of grain to the Soviet Union. So my dad would sometimes joke when we were growing up that Jimmy Carter was the best president we had, because business was booming in Port Cartier. And I remember as a kid going down to the Russian ships, and they were absolutely enormous. Took up the entire length of the port. Could only come in at high tide and leave at high tide. The Russian captains always brought us little pins and things of Lenin and what have you. I still have some of those. Anyway, so that's sort of my childhood. And then I went to university outside of Quebec. I started my studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, where I was actually a chemistry major. And that lasted about 2 years, I'd say. But I was always interested in history. It was from high school and right through the first 2 years of university, I still took history courses. And then I just finally decided that I might as well follow my passion. As much as I've found elements of chemistry quite interesting, I decided to switch over to history. And at that point, I began to acquire German because I'd always been interested in German history, just in high school and what have you. It seemed so compelling, especially the Second World War, the Nazi era. I suppose that's typical. So I started to acquire German, and it just moved on from there. At master's, I went to the University of New Brunswick, which is on the eastern coast of Canada. And then for PhD, I went to McGill in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And so it was a little bit of returning home to my home province of Quebec. And I worked there with an absolutely wonderful mentor named Peter Hoffman. Mm-hmm. Who you might know from the work on the German resistance to Hitler and the Stauffenberg assassination attempt, and it was a little bit in the news with the movie Valkyrie. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I appreciated, one of the many things that I appreciated about Peter Hoffman's supervision was his absolute meticulous attention to detail. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, he really instilled in me that idea that history is a dialogue between the small and the big, but you have to get the small right. Mm-hmm. You have to get the details right. Otherwise, that dialogue breaks down. And so I was trained very much in close attention to the documents, very, very typical Rankian approach to history. Mm-hmm. And if you read any of Peter Hoffman's material, you'll see it's exactly like that. It's meticulous. It's detailed. It's absolutely accurate. And that really rubbed off on me. So that's the kind of material that I work with, the kind that I'm comfortable with, and the type of methodology that I like to employ. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Peter Hoffman works on is resistance in the Third Reich. But I was interested when I started at McGill in doing slightly different sort of resistance in Eastern Germany. So after the war, Peter Hoffman, of course, is a resistance scholar, so he was very comfortable supervising that topic, and the timing was good as far as the archives go, because I started at McGill in 1993, and that was just a year or two after the Stasi archives opened, and some of the material from the East was really becoming accessible. Mm-hmm. So it was a gold mine of material, and I began, I guess, in the archives in Berlin and in other of the Eastern provinces in 1994. I think, that's when I moved to Berlin, and I lived there, and I worked on my dissertation there. So that was how I got into the topic of East German history in the first place. It was just the timing was very good as far as the archives becoming open.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how did you come to write a book about the Stasi itself?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was doing my first book, which was on opposition in East Germany, and I looked at some of these groups, these underground groups that worked in Eastern Germany right after the war, 1945 till maybe they peter out in the late 50s. They're very poorly researched, and not many people, certainly in the general public, would know about these groups. Social Democrats went underground and handed out pamphlets and things, and one of the major ones was a group called Fighting Group Against Inhumanity. And they were based in West Berlin, and they engaged in low-level sabotage. They would blow up the occasional statue or something like that, certainly spreading pamphlets around, trying to instigate unrest. The leader of that Fighting Group Against Inhumanity eventually went on to found a museum in West Berlin that almost every North American student backpacker visits, which is the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, has all those great stories of these wild escapes from East Germany. So I was working on those groups. And to do so, I looked at the Stasi files, because they were the ones who were hunting those groups. And I realized that there was an incredible amount of information contained in those files. So for my next project, I knew I wanted to work more or less exclusively with the Stasi files.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really influenced as well by a book by William Sheridan Allen. Perhaps you know it. It's the classic Nazi seizure of power, where he looks at the establishment of the Nazi regime in a small town.
I don't know if – I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't know if that book's read anymore, but in my day, and I think in your day too, it was everybody had read that book by the time they got there.
Yeah, I mean it's a great read. You know, you get to know.
It really is a great book. Yeah,
the bookstore owner who's the first Nazi in town and what have you. And I thought to myself, you know, there's not something similar for East Germany, sort of what life in a small town in East Germany. And then I did some more digging, and I found that the Stasi, which had these county offices in the 217 counties of East Germany, that those county offices were actually more important in monitoring the population than the headquarters in Berlin or even the regional offices in the, you know, what were the 15 regions of East Germany. In fact, those county offices ran more informants. They ran just over 50% of the informants than the other offices combined. So I realized that these county offices were critical in maintaining regime authority, and that there was no history of them. Nobody had actually looked yet at these county offices. Now, I noticed that the archive in Germany today, the Stasi archive, which has a research branch, is in fact researching another county office. But my book deals with two county offices because I wanted to have a comparative factor. And I have to say it really worked out well because I could see from looking at these county offices just how the East German regime monitored East German society.
Let me stop you right there and ask a couple of questions that I think our listeners will want answered. And I'm sorry if they seem sort of simplistic, but they just occur to me. One is,
sure.
Why was something like the Stasi set up after the Second World War? And the background to that question is, you would think the Germans had had enough of secret police. And then the second question is, why, after the Stasi was dismantled, did they not completely destroy all of their archives? Why does anything survive? So maybe you could take those in one, too. You see how they're kind of related in a way. Yeah.
I would say, to answer the first question about why was the Stasi established in the first place, is that there is a transition period. So it's not established right away. It's established in 1950, on February 8th, 1950. So this is, in fact, the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Stasi. And so there was an intervening 5 years. And in the early scholarship, especially in the from the West German, from West German scholars, there was this thought that the Stasi was the Red Gestapo. You know, that simply the Gestapo had changed its hat and become the Stasi. And we now know definitively that that is not the case, that the Stasi was founded basically from scratch, that there's one thing that the communists hated the capitalists, that's for sure, but they hated the fascists even more. So they sure as heck were not going to have fascists in their secret police. So there are essentially no Gestapo officers who are taken in to the Stasi. That said, they did use some people with a fascist past, some guards at concentration camps as informants. So they kind of used the blackmail card against them. So there wasn't the same kind of trepidation about using a former Gestapo or former SS as an informant, but there certainly was as a regular officer in the Stasi. It was founded in 1950, still relatively small, but primarily as a protector of the embryonic economy and the new state-run economy that was being established. There was concern about saboteurs or those who would ruin the new economy. So there was that kind of premise. The important thing, though, is that it was really a creature of the Soviets. So the KGB was intimately involved in the establishment of the Stasi. In fact, it ran the Stasi for the first good many years. It had so-called advisors in the Stasi, but they were really the ones who were running the show. And so it was the Soviets did desire a German, sort of indigenous German presence to monitor East German society. First, ostensibly with the economy in mind, but then, of course, it expanded to political opponents and just general surveillance. How much the Germans noticed it at first? Probably not so much. And certainly after 1953, with that massive uprising that sweeps through East Germany, there is more of a Stasi presence. The Stasi grows, becomes quite large by 1971, and then of course by 1989 is the largest secret police per capita in world history. So I would say it's a little more gradual at the beginning, but certainly, it's experiencing the Hitler dictatorship and then the communist dictatorship. Well, the truth of the matter is, yes, people had had enough. People did not want that again, and we witnessed the largest exodus in history, with one in six East Germans leaving East Germany for West Germany, and that leads, of course, to the building of the Berlin Wall in August 1961.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the second question. Why didn't they just destroy it all? You know, they came closer than people think. Because of the mammoth collection that's remained, I think we sometimes are sort of bewildered that they didn't destroy more. There are about 180 kilometers of documents in the archives. It's astonishing. I don't know whether it would be about 120 miles. Absolute huge collection, and that doesn't include all of the other things. For example, the recordings, the tape recordings that they had, also huge numbers of those. The scent rags, you know, what the Stasi used. If you've ever seen the movie The Lives of Others, you know, where they take a scent from a potential opponent so that they can present it to dogs to track down the person who were to go underground. All that stuff is also in the Stasi archives, so it's just an absolutely mammoth collection. But there are parts of it that were completely destroyed, and one was the foreign espionage material. So the Marcus Wolff's famed foreign espionage branch of the Stasi, all of the material was destroyed. We do have bits and pieces of informant names and cover names and what have you that ended up in the States and have been transferred back to Germany, but we don't have the material itself. The documents have been destroyed. That was agreed to by the citizens as well, the citizens' committees in 1989. They just felt that material was dangerous, that it could fall into the wrong hands, and so the citizens' committees themselves agreed with the Stasi that they could destroy that. So they were, in many ways, accomplices.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out to people, you make this point in the book, and you talk about it at some length, and I think there's a good reason for it. We usually don't think about kind of truth and reconciliation in the Western context, but the fact of the matter is these archives contain lists of people who were informants for the regime, people that today would not have been looked upon in a very favorable light, and some of them are your brother and wife and cousin. And so there's good reason to be worried about letting this information out.
Well, that's true. In fact, you know, the Stasi themselves did destroy a lot of the material, not only the foreign espionage material, but out in the regional branches too. They systematically destroyed an awful lot, starting in late November 1989. But it's not that easy to destroy that much material. You know, I sometimes compare it to trying to rip up a phone book.
Yeah,
you have to, you know, shredders. The shredders were quickly burned out. it's true. They started doing it by hand. They actually burned some of the guys I talked to burned material behind barns. They fed it into the coal fireplaces in the precincts. They did try to destroy material, but there was just so much of it that they couldn't get through very much. By the time the citizens themselves stormed the Stasi buildings in December 1989, and then in January 1990, they stormed the main headquarters in Berlin, and they secured the archival material themselves. Some citizens talked about in their town how the destruction material, the burning of this material, made it seem like it was snowing, you know, all the little particles, paper particles in the air. And that's sort of the level of destruction that was taking place. So the citizens themselves secured the archives and saved the material. And that's also one of the things that is absolutely fascinating about the revolution that took place in 1989 is that East German citizens occupied what was still an intact secret police. I mean, this doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. I imagine Langley, Virginia doesn't worry so much about citizens just storming it and taking it over, but it's more or less exactly what happened in East Germany in 1989. Mm-hmm. But yes, once the material was there, then once the material was secured, then of course you have the agonizing debate, exactly what you suggest, of what to do with it.
Yeah, what to do with it.
You know, should you then, as a democratic society, take the decision to destroy it all, considering the absolutely explosive material, the damning reports of family members against other family members, the obvious ruining of families and destroying of friendships that would take place, and not to mention the possibility of retaliatory murder. People were very concerned about that, that there would be people who would go to the archives, see what their friends had said about them, and come out and actually kill the person. That has not happened. There's not one instance of that, thankfully, of course. Yes, the material has been very, very hard for many people to deal with. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I still think it was the right decision, and it allows, certainly for many people, it allows them
a certain
measure of closure.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Where are the archives now, and who is in control of them?
So, almost immediately. So even before Germany unified in 1990, East Germany itself, now with a freely elected, first freely elected government in its history, which took place in March 1990, they decided that they would establish a special commission for the Stasi files. That was taken over when Germany unified, and it's now a federal commission for the files of the State Security Service of the former GDR. It's got a very long name. But so they're in the hands of this federal commission, and it does several things. It holds the archives and protects the material and catalogs it and does all the kind of usual things that archives do. It will also investigate people. This was one of its biggest jobs. So anybody who had a Stasi past was banned from the public sector in Germany. It's not the case anymore, but for the first 15 years after unification, they were banned from working in, as teachers, government employees, even in certain cases, railway workers and what have you. So one of their jobs was to respond to queries from employers to say, so-and-so has applied for a job with us. Can you check if they were a Stasi informant or a Stasi officer? And the archive would do that. That was an enormously time-consuming task and really ate up a lot of its budget. They also have a research branch that produces very, very good scholarly material. They have some excellent historians who are working on-site. So they are also producing texts on the Stasi and educational materials on the Stasi, and that's part of its mandate. The main files are still held where they were held when East Germany existed, which is on Normannenstrasse in East Berlin, where the headquarters is. And so you don't read the material there. If you're just a researcher, you read the material actually close to Alexanderplatz in the heart of East Berlin. They bring the material in for you. But the files are actually held out in where the headquarters used to be. But there are also regional archives in each of the cities, the provincial cities, so Schwerin and Magdeburg and Dresden, and so there's also regional archives. Because I was working on a regional topic, I worked in the archives in Schwerin and in Potsdam. Potsdam has since moved to Berlin. They consolidated there. So the material's held in these various locations, actually, and as an East German, very advantageous because you don't have to go to Berlin to see your files. Mm-hmm. You can just go to the nearest town.
Mm-hmm. I see. So you picked two small districts. I think we would call them something like counties here in the United States.
And they were, I
don't have the book in front of me, but it's Perleberg and Granze. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about where they are and what they're like.
Oh, yeah. Well, the question I encounter, particularly from Germans, when I mentioned that I studied Granze and Perleberg, the usual answer or query I get is, what in God's name possessed you to study Granze and Perleberg?
I get that a lot here in Iowa. Don't worry.
These are out-of-the-way places. There's really no real distinguishing feature to them. So, for example, historians are often interested in hotbeds of revolution, so a place with a university or a particularly sensitive industry like the optics works in Jena, for example, Jena. Have some micro studies of those places. But Granze and Perleberg, there's really not much to them. Perleberg is... the county of Perleberg is almost exactly halfway between Berlin and Hamburg, and it has two main cities, Perleberg, which is an administrative center, and then a working class town of Wittenberge. And Wittenberge has a couple industries in it. It has a sewing machine factory, used to be a Singer sewing machine factory, and in the East German times, it produced a sewing machine called Veritas that was very well known in East Germany, in fact, was of decent enough quality that could be exported both to the West and to the Soviet Union. Also had a synthetic oil plant, so margarine and cottonseed oil plant, that kind of thing. Also a very large rail works that's still there. The other three main factories in town have since closed. So it was a little more of a working class than Perleberg. But no real sensitive sites such. Granze is slightly northeast of Berlin. Also not much there apart from today tourists might find their way there because there is Ravensbrück, which is a former concentration camp for female inmates, also run, some of the guards were female there, most of them were female there. So it's of interest to historians because of the gender presence. There were a lot of military bases in Granze. There were Soviet military bases and East German military bases. So the Stasi was, I would say, a little more nervous in Granze than it was in other places because of this very, very strong military presence. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, there's no real distinguishing features. I have to say they are quite beautiful areas. It's very flat there. It's in the North German plain. Mm-hmm. There's great cycling today. They're really trying to build their economies around cycling. In fact, Granze, the Berlin-Copenhagen bike path goes right past Granze. It goes right past the Ravensbrück, former concentration camp. And so there's a little bit of a tourist industry growing up around cycling in the areas today. But if pressed, I would say they're a little bit depressed after certainly after some of the changes that occurred when the wall fell and the industries closed and they're trying to reinvent themselves. But the Elbe River goes quite close to Wittenberge. Actually, goes right along Wittenberge, and then drifts away. But it is a strikingly mm-hmm. beautiful area, and mm-hmm. it's for many East Germans they sort of find their way up there as a weekend away from Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So let's actually begin the story of. A kind of Stasi career, because in a way what you do is a sort of prosopography. It's not quite in the statistical sense, but you talk to people who were involved with the Stasi in one way or another. So let's begin a career at the beginning. How did you make your way into the Stasi as an agent?
How did they recruit people?
Well, it changed over time. So maybe I'll start with the end. Because that's the easiest to understand. At the end, they were increasingly just recruiting from their own offspring. So, it made so much sense because was incredibly labor-intensive to vet a candidate. And this is one thing that I think really we need to pay a little bit more attention to, is just how many people in East Germany would have been monitored, even if only briefly, because they were in the acquaintance circle of somebody who was being considered for officer duty in the Stasi or as an informant, because they monitored more or less everybody in your acquaintance circle. So your family and friends, if you had siblings, their families, typically male, so the wife and her family, they were all investigated. Now, that was so labor-intensive that as the years went on, they realized that most of that work would already have been done. And so if you took the son or daughter of a Stasi officer, then you really saved yourself a lot of work because you already had vetted mm-hmm. most of the family. So that's increasingly what they did.
Just like the mafia.
What's that?
I say just like the mafia.
Yeah.
Think about it, yeah.
That's right. But before that, typically they would recruit from something called the Felix Dzerzhinsky Regiment, which was a regiment that guarded party and Stasi buildings, primarily in Berlin. And if you wanted to do your military service in the Felix Dzerzhinsky Regiment, you knew what it was. It meant that you were guarding Stasi and party installations. And that immediately meant that you were probably predisposed to some kind of Stasi work. And so when you went to the recruiting office, as you probably know, military service was compulsory in East Germany. Mm-hmm. When you went to your recruiting office, when you had to show up, I forget what age it was, 18 or something, they would ask all sorts of questions, and a Stasi officer would be there, unbeknownst to the candidate. Stasi officer would be there to hear how the candidate was responding to questions about entering the military, and for example, volunteered to do longer military service than required, that was certainly something that the Stasi would notice and follow up on. And if they had indicated interest in joining the Felix Dzerzhinsky Regiment instead of the regular army, that was also something that was of interest to the Stasi recruiter who sat in on this conversation. So this was sort of a bit of background preparation. Then the candidate would go off and they would join the military or wherever they went. They would typically then have to work. It was very important for the Stasi that their employees had experienced life as a worker. So many of them were, I wouldn't say just ordinary laborers, but slightly higher than that, although not quite technocrats. And they would do that typically for a few years. And then the Stasi would sort of evaluate this pattern. So what had they said from the time that they were recruited into the army? What kind of experience had they had as a worker? And then they might make the approach at that point. Nobody volunteered for service in the Stasi. In fact, if that had happened, the Stasi would probably deny them for good because, well, they were always worried about moles. So you were approached. You were always approached by the Stasi rather than the other way around. And so typically they were recruited out of the Felix Dzerzhinsky Regiment. That was the main recruiting grounds. But as I said, as time went on, it became increasingly family members.
Mm-hmm. And these were, let's talk a little bit about gender. These were almost always men.
Yes. Also, I think very important to keep in mind is not only were the officers almost all men, about 85% to 90%. But almost all of the informants, too, mm-hmm. about 85% of the informants. And even for the officers, there were women who worked for the Stasi. So when you see the overall numbers, you know, there are 91,000 people who worked for the Stasi in 1989. And when you see the overall numbers, you can see that there are some women who work there, but they're almost all in some support duty.
Mm-hmm.
They're either custodial, secretarial. In Berlin, there are some who work in the mail opening departments. There are virtually no female operational officers,
mm-hmm.
you know, ones who would run informants, ones who would be out in the field monitoring, virtually none. So it's very, very interesting that in East Germany, which prided itself on equality of labor and the advancement of women, in the Stasi absolutely has no place for them.
Yeah. So Now, let's say I'm in the Stasi now. I'm a young man. I'm in the Stasi. I worked. I did all the things I have to do. What's next? Do I go to school? Is there Stasi school?
Yeah, there's Stasi school. That's right. So once you join the Stasi, the first thing is an elaborate ceremony where you go and you swear your oath of allegiance. You usually do it with your group of incoming your incoming class. And some people will hold the flag, the East German flag at the front of the class while this big swearing-in ceremony takes place. And they do it for all of the employees of the Stasi, so not just the officers. And some of the secretaries that I interviewed thought this was really intimidating, you know, that they just join the Stasi for a job to, to transcribe a few things. The next thing, they're swearing this oath of allegiance in front of a sea of East German flags. So you did that, and then you typically read up on directives and case studies, particularly exemplary operations that had happened in the Stasi, and pretty especially in your district. And then before you went to school, you typically engaged in some very low level surveillance that almost everybody in the office would make fun of you for. So you would have to sit in your trabby outside the train station and tick off who was coming and going. You would have to again, some of this vetting that took place. You just have to sit and monitor somebody whose job, let's say, would take them in contact with the West, maybe a truck driver or something like that. And you just have to sit and monitor their comings and goings. I mean, completely boring, completely mundane, before you moved up and started running informants and having what would for them be more interesting work. There were several schools that the Stasi had. The Stasi had specialized schools, for example, in foreign language training. And they had a school in Grunze. Now, that's just coincidence, by the way, that they actually have the school in the district that I studied. But a lot of Stasi officers would know Grunze from going to school there, which typically taught them things about Russian history, taught them about history of the secret police, communism, the problems of the Western world. Sort of a base knowledge in Marxism and the secret police history, I would say. Mm-hmm. And that was something that almost all the officers did at a base level. Then they had the more sophisticated school that was in Potsdam. The Stasi College of Law, euphemistically named, and there they got into much more detailed things about operations. They wrote dissertations, for example. It was a four-year course. Most of them had to move there to do it. You could do it a little bit by distance education, but most of them had to move to Potsdam and stay there for the duration. These theses are absolutely fascinating. They're one of the great collections, I think, in the Stasi archive. It's all the theses that were written, all the dissertations that were written by Stasi officers at this so-called Stasi College of Law. And they're very detailed operational issues, not like the general questions of Marxism, for example, at the Grunze School. And it's just it's interesting. One of the officers that I interviewed, he was telling me that Marcus Wolf came to as one of the guest lecturers at this school, and he just sat there at the front with no notes. This Stasi officer was very impressed that Marcus Wolf would sit there with no notes and just talk about how one engages in espionage. And he talked for hours on end.
So, all right, now I've gone to school and everything. Do I get to run informants now? Do I get to find informants? Co-workers, I think they're Mitarbeitern or something.
Right.
What do they call
them? Yeah. Unofficial co-workers is the exact translation. And it's interesting, when I talk to the Stasi officers, they still think of them that way. They think of them as co-workers, not as somebody they were running to monitor, but these actual like colleagues, partners in arms. And some of them are still in touch with them. Just as an aside, one of the people that I interviewed, he was definitely the most remorseful. I would say the only one who was really remorseful at all about what he had done. He regretted it. And after the wall fell, he reinvented himself. He went to school for 3 years and he became a physiotherapist. It's a very successful physiotherapy practice on the main square in one of the towns. And some of his patients are his former informants.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange that, you know, they come in and you know, he puts ice on their knee and they talk about the old days. Anyway. So once you've kind of done the base training and you begin to move up the ranks, you are put in charge of informants. And at first your roster would be quite small, under 10. But as time goes on, you build it up, and towards the end, you typically run 25 to 30 informants, which of course is a huge roster of informants. I mean, there's certainly something of a law of diminishing returns coming in, mm-hmm. into effect. Because it's hard to meet with them, you just don't have the time in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, some of them are better than others, and so you try to bring the other ones along, and it's just increasingly time-consuming. So once you become what they called an informant running officer, you were moving up through the ranks. That would typically be within 10 years you would probably reach captain status,
mm-hmm.
and be running informants,
mm-hmm.
in certainly one of the precincts. This is the ones that I know best.
I was going to say, how did you find your informants? Who did you pick?
They would typically. You know, they would typically start off by thinking of where they needed informants.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe the sewing machine factory, maybe the railway outfitting works, church, what have you. And then they would investigate that situation to see who might be a reasonable candidate for an informant. How would they do that? They would talk with the factory boss. They would talk with the school principal. Churches were harder, of course, because they couldn't. They didn't have their ready-made informants in there like they would in a factory or a school, mm-hmm. or something. Now, that was sort of the ideal, but the reality was very different. And this is one of the points that I make, is that this sort of what looks like targeted surveillance really breaks down, because frequently they would take somebody who, they didn't necessarily need in a certain site. For example, if a school principal ever said, which they often did, I think that this individual would be a good candidate as an informant, the Stasi would leap at that, regardless of whether the school they thought was a particularly strategic site or something that needed to be monitored. They would leap at it because, I mean, this was a young informant, and they needed to be aware of what was happening. So they would take that. Hospitals, medical sector, those were heavily penetrated. So typically the Stasi would talk to the chief of medicine or the hospital administrator, and they would be frequently informants themselves, but they would also ask, you know, well, who among the physician corps or the assistants here might make a suitable informant. So they typically use their own networks. Police officers frequently would talk to them about possible informants. And then, of course, once you have informants, you can use them to find other informants. It sort of builds on itself.
So what did you want your informants to do?
There were different levels of informants. So some of them actually worked operations. So, for example, one of the operations I talk about, one of the most interesting ones, was this operation that took place in 1987 when two boys went to a Soviet base near Granze, and they were scaling into it. This is something that they'd done in the past. They tended to steal little things for their mopeds, spare parts, and what have you. And one night they did this, and a Russian soldier, a young Russian soldier, who was on duty, saw them scurrying in, told them to get out, fired a warning shot in the air. They did. One of them ran out. The other one was already in the forest, and he was running away. And the Soviet soldier gave chase, which was highly unusual, and he actually shot them both dead. Now, that was scandalous. They were running away from him, and in fact, the autopsy revealed that. The Russian soldier himself said that that they had a weapon and they were turning to fire at him. The doctor who performed the autopsy said very clearly, and it's quite striking in the documents, that there is an inconsistency in the Russian soldier's account, because the bullet is in the back. The bullet entry wound is in the back. So what we have is a Russian soldier who shoots these teenage boys running away from him in peacetime in 1987. I mean, Gorbachev is already in. It's very close to the end. Of course, a tragedy. So the Stasi has to exercise damage control. And they use their informant to do so. So the first thing they have to do is monitor the father of those two boys, because they don't want him to know exactly what happened. Of course he knows that his kids have been killed, but they don't want him to know that they were shot in the back. That was very important. And so they would use informants. You know, one category of informants would be this kind of informant who worked a specific operation. So this situation arises. They take these informants and they say, okay, you monitor this person. You befriend him if you have to. Find out his other friends. Just get into his circle of acquaintances and monitor him. Make sure he's not talking about it. Find out whatever you can, any plans that he might have against the Russians, or to try to find out what his boys had, how his boys had really died and what happened. The mother, by the way, was the parents had divorced, and the mother had moved away. And it's interesting; it was never very clear in the documents why she didn't play more of a role. I think she really had just been out of their lives for a while, so she's not a factor in this. The father is the subject of the operation. So that's one category of informant, the one who works in operation. Another is just a general societal observer, somebody who would tell you if somebody had told a joke about the East German leader, plenty of examples of those. If they had overheard something in a pub, especially in the earlier days, I mean, in the 1950s and 1960s, the documents are just rife with these absolutely what seemed to me innocuous observations by the informants. So-and-so was talking to a woman on the phone at his workplace. Well, the guy's married. It turned out to be his wife. There was, somebody else was doing the rounds with one of these calculator games. If you multiply Eric Honecker's phone number by the year that the Communist Party was founded, and you divide it by those games, and you turn it upside down, and what it says is Scheiße, in German. Well, this was duly reported, innocuous. But again, the Stasi investigates it. One of the Stasi informants they had worked at a movie theater. The illustriously named Alhambra Movie Theater.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And so he worked at the Alhambra Movie Theater, and he would just report on who came to the movies. He came with long hair. That was very suspicious. Other kids were kind of hooting and hollering at some point. I mean, the kind of thing that would go on here, and nobody would really pay much mind to it. Mm-hmm. But the Stasi instigates it. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, one of the funny things there was there's a movie that they wanted to show, but it had some scene about the Prague Spring in it, it's from 1968. And so they asked their informant to clip out that scene. Well, of course, he clips out the wrong scene. So that the 1968 Prague Spring stays on, and something else celebrating the glorious Bulgarian movement in something, I don't know what it was, that gets clipped out. So the Stasi was mortified that this guy chopped the wrong scene. So you had general societal observers as informants. You had these ones who actually worked cases. And then you had another category of informant altogether who just offered their apartment as a place for an officer to meet with an informant. And those were called conspiratorial dwelling informants. So think of them as a safe house or something. But see, I mean, the issue was these officers had to meet with their informants. They had to meet them somewhere. They couldn't meet at the precinct. They couldn't meet at the informant's workplace. So they had to meet somewhere else. Sometimes, if the weather was nice, they'd meet outside in parks. They'd go for a walk in the forest or something. But it was always better to have a place where they could meet. So some informants didn't actually inform for the Stasi. They simply gave their house keys, which in itself is a big deal, gave their house keys to the Stasi officer to use, and then they would be away from them.
Were the informants
at the time?
I'm sorry. Were the informants paid?
No.
Did they get anything?
They got little bonuses, little presents. Sometimes, for example, on their birthday, or if it was a female, the rare case when it was a female informant on International Women's Day, you know, they might get a bouquet of flowers. They might get a little monetary bonus. They might get a delivery of coal.
Why did they
really nothing?
If they weren't paid, why did they do it?
Yeah, this is
That's sort of the money question, as we would say, isn't it?
Money question, yeah. There's been a lot of really good work on motivations of informants, and as you might expect, it runs the gamut. Some of them, there's no question, were believers in the cause, and they felt that they were doing something to support the East German state, you know, the more peaceful Germany compared to the fascist West Germany. They actually believed that kind of thing, so they wanted to become informants. Others who feared the consequences of saying no, I mean, obviously, once you were approached by the Stasi, and you, we know that if they said no, nothing happened to them. The Stasi simply just sent their file to the archive, and that was it. Of course, they didn't know that at the time. They certainly would have feared consequences. So some of them did fear. Others liked a little bit of the power that was involved. Some of them, I would say the very rare case, tried to kind of use it against the Stasi. That happened a little bit in the earlier period, not so much in the later period, where they would, you know, try to use the information they attained by working with the Stasi to their own advantage, you know, mm-hmm. to try to get out of East Germany and what have you. But again, that was fairly rare. So varying motivations.
So let me ask the following question, because I just find it fascinating. And I may be reading this wrong, and you as a student of the opposition or lack thereof can answer this, I think. We were talking a few weeks ago to Steve Kotkin, who sort of studied the events of 1989, the revolutions of 1980. We also talked to Padraig Kenny on the show, and one of the things that that seems clear to me, at least both of them sort of said, that with the exception of Poland, there was no organized opposition anywhere in Eastern Europe after the 1950s. Organized. Mm-hmm. Now, there was some opposition, but there was no organized opposition. So if that is true, there was nothing for the Stasi to find. Yet they continued to look. So how are we to understand this? That year after year, I mean, you have people that you interview who say, I worked for 20 years, I never found anything, but, you know, X was screwing Y's wife. Pardon my French.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. That is a very interesting refrain from the Stasi officers that I interviewed, that this sort of disillusionment that sets in. They expected to find the saboteurs. You know, they actually expected to find the wreckers, you know, the ones who were going in and deliberately wrecking production. Or one of the ones that I talk about, which I think is kind of funny, is that, you know, they heard that there were East German dissidents out there that were improperly milking the cows, you know, so that they...
We got wouldn't... here in Iowa, too. No.
Yeah. And you know, some Stasi officers that I interviewed actually joined the Stasi on this premise. You know, they wanted to find those improper milkers, and of course, they didn't. They didn't exist. And as one of them said, you know, I found lots of people who were lazy, but I didn't find anybody who I consider a real regime opponent. So the question is why? You know, why did they have? Well, they did other things. I mean, of course, there was a paranoia, and I would say an institutionalized paranoia that grew over the years. And because they made the informant the backbone of their repression apparatus, it had no choice but to grow. You know, because if you say that the bottom line is how many informants you have, well, then you just keep pressure on your officer class to get more informants, and every year they increase the number of informants. So, you know, as I said, one person trying to run 25 informants, it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. And in the districts that I looked at, you know, the Stasi was typically meeting 7 times a day, every day, with informants. So there were seven separate meetings with informants from the case officers. I mean, these are small precincts. Granze only had 35 employees. It included everybody. That included the building security. That included the custodial, the secretarial. So in that district, seven times a day, they're meeting with informants every single day of the year. I think this is one of the great weaknesses of the Stasi, is that by putting so much emphasis on the informants, they just focused on having this huge roster of informants. They equated more informants with greater security, and they didn't really think about whether, you know, there was much to monitor, which, as you said, there really wasn't, especially in these out-of-the-way areas. But they did, they did other things, too. So, for example, they engaged in making sure that medical professional didn't leave. And this was a real issue for them. Even after 1961, many physicians, many dentists were able to sneak out of East Germany, especially because they were going to a conference or something related to their work. They could just stay in. So prevention of that kind of thing was one of the occupations that they had. Also monitoring for spies, even out in the district that I looked at, they always had Department 2 that dealt with counter-espionage, a little more present in Grande because of the number of military bases that were there. So they would deal with some things that we might think of as pretty typical of a secret police, in terms of counter-espionage. So they had these other things that they were working on. It also increased the roster. But it is fascinating that they developed this huge apparatus for what they thought might be lurking out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that I come back to on that is John Giak's history of the KGB, which is that since the Bolsheviks were a conspiracy that gained power, they were always very concerned that there were other people like them out there.
Mm-hmm.
There were other conspiracies in the making. And I think that mentality was brought over to the Stasi. Certainly we know the Russian influence was very strong, that you always had to be, as communists in particular, you always had to be on the lookout for conspiracy.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. Did you ever find in your interview somebody who was kind of reflective on that very question? That is, did they ever say, for example, I didn't really understand why we were preventing people from going to the West if they wanted to.
There was one officer that I talked to, who was very well educated and never offered party platitudes. Always had something thoughtful to say, and he talked about this issue of preventing certainly those in the health sector from leaving. And he said, to me that's not a question of communism or capitalism or dictatorship or democracy. If a dentist leaves, then thousands of people in the district go without dental care.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought of it in those terms, that sort of preventing them was the right thing to do because of the health care that would suffer, and that these people would, ordinary people would suffer if physicians, dentists left. But others reflected very much on this vetting and these endless just reports on the population. The vetting of everybody, so candidates for the Stasi as informants or officers, those who would be traveling west in their line of work, those who would be particularly sensitive positions. The Stasi vetted all of these people, and they just thought it was an incredibly enormous amount of work for really that didn't have to fall to the Stasi. Almost anybody could have done that. And some of them did reflect on what they called a perverted level of surveillance. For example, if there was any kind of public event, in 1989, Perleberg celebrated the 750th anniversary of its founding.
Mm-hmm.
They had a celebration for it, as would be typical. Buskers and bands and kids events and all that kind of thing. Well, the Stasi was absolutely paranoid about this,
mm-hmm.
And had a special task force established and had informants everywhere, informants at the evening dances, informants at the parades, you know, informants at the church at an open house. So there was informants at the church. I mean, this kind of absolutely saturated penetration of just a public event. Some officers did think that that was something that really the Ministry for State Security, you know, didn't have to deal with. The Ministry for State Security didn't have to deal with buskers.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
It had other things. That their view was there were other things that they should be dealing with, but this was the kind of day-to-day work that they
had. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, I got a ticket once for riding my bike on the sidewalk, and that's kind of what I thought about the cop who gave it to me.
Oh.
I was like, look,
yeah,
don't you have anything better to do?
Yes.
I deserved it, though. I admit it. I deserved it.
I don't know.
I was busted. I did it. I was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. But anyway, let me ask one final question about the Stasi before I ask you what you're working on now. How have the and this is a kind of an interesting part of the story, and I'm glad that you tell it. These people are still alive. How have they fared in the new Federal Republic? Or actually, it's not the Federal Republic anymore. What is it? It's a what do they call that now?
Yeah. No, it is the Federal Republic.
It's the Federal Republic, right? Yeah. So how have they fared?
Well, if you ask me, they fared quite well. If you ask them, it's been a catastrophe. They get state pensions because they were in essentially the public sector in East Germany. And most of them, I mean, of course there was a transition period, and some of them found jobs. Some of them were young enough to be trained, but I would say most of the ones that I interviewed just found something tied them over to retirement. Some of them worked low-level security. One was a physiotherapist. One of them opened a convenience store. Some of them moved away. A couple of the ones who worked in the district moved to West Germany. I wasn't able to track them down. One of them moved to Sweden. Another one worked in the district had a terrible demise. He got involved in drugs and ended up being murdered in Hamburg. For the most part, they've adjusted. I think I interviewed most of them in their home setting. They all seem comfortable. They have decent places to live and sort of surrounded by nice things. They tend to spend most of their time with their family. Very few of them talk about Stasi anymore with really anybody. One of them, his kid continued to deny it. His father worked for the Stasi when they're out in public. For the most part, you know, they're not completely down and out. They've just gone on with life, and for the most part, it's been a decent, maybe again not as lucrative a job as the one side, but it's been a decent living, and they're quite comfortable now.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, the younger ones, there was one younger one. I mean, he started a transportation company with somebody who actually worked in an office with him,
The reason I ask this is because a lot of them in your interviews, and we're about to run out of time, because I want you to deal with this quickly. In the interviews, a lot of them were afraid they were going to be strung up from lampposts in 19.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them were very worried about retaliation.
That hasn't happened. There hasn't been any retaliation. Nobody's been, as far as we know.
No, not in the ones.
And none of them has been charged.
Really not the ones that I've dealt with. And the other, like, broadly, no, there hasn't been a lot of public, you know, engagement, humiliation, or retaliation with the Stasi officers. In fact, in 2006, it was something remarkable where there was a service at Hohenschönhausen, which is a prison in East Berlin that the Stasi used, and there was a little memorial celebration there, and victims of the Stasi were there talking about conditions. Well, Stasi officers showed up, including the last leader of the Stasi, Wolfgang Schanitz. He showed up. They showed up at this commemorative service for the victims of the Stasi and challenged them, challenged the victims and said, well, you know, there wasn't abuse in the Stasi prison and there wasn't this and you're making it up. I mean, it's incredible affront to those who had suffered under the Stasi. So some of them are actually, some Stasi officers are still very much sort of public in East Germany and speak their minds.
I see. Well, you know, Gary, we've taken up a lot of your time and I really appreciate it. It's a terrific book. We've been talking to Gary Bruce about his new work, The Firm, The Inside Story of the Stasi. Gary, let me ask our traditional final question on new books in history, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually working on something different. It's a personal project. It's something that I've been interested in for a long time, and it's got nothing to do with the Stasi. I'm not finished with the Stasi, but I'm just working on this other project in the interim. And that is the Berlin Zoo. And I know it's a long way from the Stasi, but the Berlin Zoo has a fascinating history. I mean, it was founded by the absolute luminaries of East Germany. can't get it out of my mind. Of Germany, people like Alexander von Humboldt and Lepsius, the great Egyptologist. And along the way, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the Berlin Zoo began exhibiting human beings, different cultural groups. So there were people in the Berlin Zoo, for example, Aboriginal Chileans, tribes of North Africa. Actually, at one point, a group of Labrador Inuit were supposed to go over, but unfortunately died in Europe. It actually was in the news a little bit lately, too. And the Berlin Zoo during the Nazi period is absolutely fascinating as well, because of an incredibly successful breeding program that they had that was used by the Nazis to breed indigenous European cattle, other animals, and introduce them into the Eastern landscape. I mean, as you know, the part of the premise of the Nazis was to make Eastern Europe German, whether it was through architecture and plants. Of course, you know, populations as well, but it involved animals as well. And so the Berlin Zoo was used for that. And of course, afterwards, the East Berlin Zoo becomes this flagship communist example. It's actually set up in an old nobility's estate. And in 1990, they join again.
It's also, incidentally, if I recall correctly, and I don't know if I do, it's also where the Nazi euthanasia program was located. It was Tiergartenstrasse something, wasn't it? Am I wrong about that? Yeah, it was right there, though.
It was T4, Tiergartenstrasse 4, but...
maybe it was someplace else. I don't know.
It's actually not so...
Totally incidental, but anyway. Yeah, I just remember Tiergartenstrasse, but yeah, anyway.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Gary, I want to say good luck on the project, and when you get it done, we'll be happy to have you back on the show. I look forward to that, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, I want to thank you, Marshall, for not only today, but for all of the great work that you've done in New Books in History. It's really terrific. And I know I think on behalf of academic and non-academics, you've done such a great service for all of us.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Gary Bruce about his new book, The Firm, The Inside Story of the Stasi. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.